Hello, welcome to the Dot Metaverse podcast. I'm Ido Siegel, CEO of Touchcast. We're leading the metaverse into the enterprise realm. Join us every week as we explore key themes and ideas surrounding the metaverse.
We have a real treat in store for you today. Charlie Fink is in the house.
So will there be a photorealistic metaverse, whatever that means? Sure, absolutely. I can't tell you when that will come about. People are predicting by 2030. I hope they're right. That's crazily optimistic, if you ask me.
Charlie is someone that really knows a lot about the flavor of the hour, the metaverse, because he's been on this journey for many years. And I think you'll find out as we go through some of these experiences that it really is very telling to look at the past cycles that we've been on this journey and what we've learned from them so we can kind of avoid making the same mistakes. And for us in this conversation, as we look to see how metaverse intersects with the world of work and enterprise, it really is critical to see beyond the fluff and the smoke screens and focus on tangible things that we can do to create value in the world. So, Charlie, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
I have one question I wanted to start with. Where were you when Disney launched their Aladdin VR experience back in the day?
I think at that point I was at AOL, but we did have a part in helping to engineer that VR experience with Disney. That was part of Disney Quest, if you recall, the ill-fated Disney Quest. And I was involved with a venture that was partly financed by Disney in location-based entertainment, which we thought at the time might or might not be incorporated into Disney Quest. But, you know, our premier title was BattleTech. And, you know, we're fighting mechs on desert planets. And that didn't exactly fit with the themes they were going for. So we helped them a little bit with the technology. It was the lamest flying carpet anywhere. And, of course, they used these giant cantilevered headsets on it with their from Fake Space or somebody.
What year was that?
94.
Yeah. And for the people listening, some of you probably were not born in 94. this was a situation where the world was very excited about virtual reality at the time. That was a cycle of virtual reality, kind of coinciding with Snow Crash, the novel that coined the metaverse. And there was this amazing development. At the time, I guess, I'm sure, Charlie, you were also going to see Graph and that type of
color.
And was seeing the digital, what was it called? The digital garden, I think. That was like VHS tapes that you would take home to show your rest of your team. And this was actually an incredible breakthrough because you felt like you're inside the cartoon. But the only way Disney could deliver that is that they had one of the rides, effectively, I think it was in Orlando, and they would fill the auditorium with people, let's say hundreds of people, and they would choose one person from the crowd and they would go on the stage and put on this big VR headset. And people would see it on, I guess, projections. I don't even know if we had projections back there. So it was supposed to be TV, and you would see this individual being immersed inside this Aladdin world. It was mind-blowing. I mean, you remember it as something that wasn't that great, but I remember it as a real milestone.
Disney has always pioneered immersive media because that is what Disneyland is. Walt Disney realized very early on that people wanted to be inside of the movies that he made and wanted to inhabit those worlds. And so he used the technology of 1950s stagecraft technology, a lot of which was 100 years old, like Pepper's Ghost, which is a reflective theory that allows you to project ghosts onto stages with nothing more than a candle and a mirror. So when, you know, you're the famous hitchhiking ghosts in the Haunted Mansion are an example of that. So very early on, Disney was trying to simulate a different kind of reality. I mean, listen, there have been dark rides for hundreds of years, and, you know, dark rides also seek to replace the input of the real world with a virtual world. So the idea of creating virtual worlds has been with us for a long time, and certainly Disney was one of the first to really understand what it was and how he might achieve it. I think were he alive, he would be very taken with virtual reality.
Yeah, probably Disney would invest more in this space. So that was 94. It's 2022. It's been a while. It's been a minute. I think we both had more hair when that happened.
Yeah.
What's changed?
Oh, gosh. Well, there's the internet now. I mean, the internet changed everything. And, you know, we knew in the 90s it was going to be consequential, but, you know, we certainly didn't understand the implication. You know, we knew computers were going to get smaller until they were, you know, this size, but we didn't obviously fully comprehend the implications of that, even though that we knew they would be enormous. But it also took a lot longer than we thought. And certainly virtual reality has taken longer than we thought to arrive. I mean, in the 90s, the most commercial application of virtual reality is what we were doing at Virtual World, which was what we called cab-based simulation. So you're sitting inside of a cabinet and looking out the windshield. And eventually we started to use very large convex mirrors, which are valuable to this day and sought after, to create a rather photorealistic view of the virtual world. But again, we were seeing it through the windshield of a vehicle. And out that windshield, you would see the other participants in the simulation driving their vehicles. And that was, you know, the fun of it was that you were competing against other people. So no two experiences were the same.
So you're saying the connectivity, massive jump forward.
Yeah.
When you say VR has arrived, do you feel that way? Do you feel that VR has arrived?
Well, I think that we've reached an important inflection point where it's ready to be commercialized. And in fact, Sony and Meta have introduced very popular low-priced consumer products. And they've seen better than modest uptake. I think Meta is selling headsets about as fast as they can get them. Now, is it good enough? Well, this is a question I ask my students all the time. Is it good enough yet? And the answer is probably not. People put, you know, I also think the word virtual reality has limited us. I wish we had said simulated reality, because most people who put on a headset, if they're not a gamer, they're like, where's reality? This is looks like I'm inside of a video game. I hate video games. I don't want to be inside of a video game. And of course, there are significant obstacles because, you know, there's no eye contact in VR. And photorealism would be a game changer. We don't have the bandwidth for that. We don't have the decompression technology. I mean, there's a whole sort of array of technologies that I have no doubt are in the process of being invented, but, you know, could be 10 years. Certainly one of the lessons that we should all take from the development of the personal computer is that we overestimate the short term and underestimate the long term. So these things tend to play out in decades. And of course, when I was young working on virtual reality, I was, I guess, in my early 30s then, you know, we were expecting things to happen in 5 years and 10 years. And these things took 30 years to play out. So will there be a photorealistic metaverse, whatever that means? Sure, absolutely. I can't tell you when that will come about. People are predicting by 2030. I hope they're right. That's crazily optimistic, if you ask me. It probably will take longer than that.
So I have to confess that at the same time, I guess 93, I was so excited that I dropped out of art school and started my first, well, it was really my second because I did it at a startup as a teenager, but my first real startup, which was a virtual reality company in 94, and that you can imagine did not go too well. It was called Virtual Arts. It was very, like I created this mural in our little tiny office, and just printing that mural cost me like a fortune. I probably had to sell an organ. And it was, I took the Sistine Chapel image of, you know, God touching man, and I put a VR headset on man's head as God was touching him, and I was inspired. So the reason I bring this up, and I kind of the prelude to the conversation, is about looking at past. I've suffered a similar experience with AI because I was in the AI field in the 80s, and we thought it was going to change everything, and then we were in the desert for like 20 years, and of course AI's last year is metaverse, and it's not going anywhere. I'm just interested in your perspective on this, because one of the areas that has always concerned me based on a lot of years dealing with this is the human factor aspect of putting something on your face, which, you know, we've seen the consumer like...
It is a change in behavior. Getting people to change their behavior is hard, really hard. And the value proposition has to be very, very powerful. And especially in the case of this kind of technology, but even the personal computer, because the amount of friction is enormous. And normal people do not put up with that much friction. And that is certainly true of even VR today, where it's as close to plug and play as you can get. Yet my experience as a corporate consultant is that there are a lot of people, smart, talented executives in big companies who aren't having it, don't like wearing it, makes them dizzy, makes them nauseous, all the usual excuses of messes up my hair. I don't like not seeing what's around me. All the usual excuses. And really, it's just another way of saying, I don't think the benefit is good enough. You know, it's too hard to change my behavior. I send my students home with the Oculus Quest, and they have these things for months. And I say, well, have you been, they come back over the summer. Well, what did you do with your headset? Well, nothing really, because the games I like to play are better on a game console. Or, you know, it just never occurred to me to use it. I was too busy socially, which really means they were looking at their phone, you know, and so they did not change their behavior by and large, because VR isn't good enough yet. It's certainly, as I said, I think it will be. I'm a big believer. I've, you know, banked my career on it, but I also truly believe what my podcast partner, Ted Shilowitz, who is one of the founders of Red Camera and the futurist at Viacom, and he says the futurist is nothing more than a pastist who believes that history repeats itself. So I've been of the mind that VR is following the development pattern of the personal computer, which took 20 years to penetrate 25% of American homes. And that was largely because of the internet, right? Because before the internet, people thought having a computer at home meant you were going to work at home. And I can't tell you how many people in that period said, what would I do with it other than work? So I would say VR is probably on a 20-year trajectory too, depending on when you want to start that trajectory. Well, let's say we started in 2012 with the founding of Oculus. Mm-hmm. You know, that puts us 10 years in, which is sort of 1993. and many people do compare, you know, 1993 and the internet and the personal computer with VR today. It's not a terrible comparison. And certainly when people are talking about 2030, well, you just about nailed the 20 years that I predict. So, you know, VR is growing quickly. I think it's a very exciting time to be in the industry. And there's a lot of convergence going on, right? Because VR isn't just about VR any more than, you know, volumetric capture is about sensors, right? There are a lot of technologies, computer vision, you know, chips, advances in chip making, you know, advances in bandwidth, 5G, you know, even 4G has had a significant impact. These things are converging together. And when you have a convergence of technologies, that's when you can have really deep change. For example, the combustion engine was not invented to power airplanes. So the steam engine was not invented to power factories, right? It was invented, Fulton invented the steam engine for ships. Yet that technology created one of the great industrial revolutions.
Yeah, and I really hate the like a devil's advocate type of conversation, but in learning from history, for some of you that don't necessarily know Charlie, you probably saw his amazing film, Bambi in Africa, which you don't know that you saw it probably, but Charlie also has this very deep bench in the entertainment space. And maybe just quickly tell our listeners what the plot of Bambi in Africa
is. Sure. I mean, I went to film school in the late 70s, early 80s. I, you know, made my way to Los Angeles and I got a job as a junior executive at Disney when I was 26. And I was in charge of developing stories for animated movies. You know, and I mean, we were pitching stories all over the place, every fairy tale, every idea we could come up with. And I said, let's do Bambi in Africa, right? It starts just like Bambi starts, with the king of the forest or the king of the jungle standing on, you know, the kopje overlooking the Serengeti, down on the thicket where his son is born. And the movie ends with that exact same shot. And in fact, Bambi is standing on the bluff and his father steps away into the darkness, leaving Bambi alone, having fully replaced his father in the circle of life. So that was the pitch. And Katzenberg said, if you can figure out why Bambi eats the other animals, maybe you have a picture. So then we said, so that started the development of the movie. And all I can say is, who knew that, you know, I would do the most consequential thing of my career when I was a 27-year-old junior executive?
You're like an Orson Welles moment you got there.
Yeah, I've spent the rest of my life trying to top it. I don't think it's going to happen.
So like through that lens as the entertainment executive, now we're rolling tape to the era of 3D TV. And now the consumer electronic industry is convinced that they are going to create a windfall that will cause people to replace all their televisions with new sets because 3D TV is upon us. And they're going to make these glasses smaller and smaller to the point that they're like literally weighs like a piece of paper. And everybody will embrace this and 3D movies will be effectively the mainstream. How do you look at what happened there, and do you think there are any lessons for the challenge?
Well, we've been chasing after 3D without glasses for a very long time. And of course, now the glasses are getting much better. But I've seen many 3D movies, and I have to say, in all fairness, it doesn't make them better. So the other thing is I do have a new TV. It's a QLED TV from Samsung, and it's the best TV I've ever owned. Certainly does not make me feel like, oh, I don't have a good enough TV. I need better TV. So I think it has to take what we're already doing and make it much, much better, right? Why did everybody switch to online shopping, right? Because it took what we were doing and it made it better, faster, and cheaper. You'd be kind of crazy not to go for that. So I think that if we're going to upgrade to different kinds of screens in our homes, the strategy will be will have to be to converge our, you know, here's a technology that hasn't been disrupted for 400 years. You know, somebody could disrupt this technology, half the people in the world wear glasses, but electronic glasses, which would be capable of doing 3D TV, for example, would, as I said, in fact, have a lot of friction. You'd have to charge them. You'd still have to have a pair of analog glasses around. Because they're not going to work 100% of the time. You know, you're going to forget to charge them. They're not going to charge properly. They're going to break. You're going to, I don't know. So I you know, they're going to be for first adopter devices for quite a while. Now, there was a rumor, you know, Apple is working, is the source of many rumors at XR, partly because they've got distributed groups all over the world working on similar projects, or at least projects that involve XR technology. Both AR and VR. So one of the patents they filed for, and by the way, this doesn't mean they're making it. One of the patents that they applied for would, in fact, try and disrupt vision correction using retina scanning and external facing sensors. So again, a convergence of several technologies. And what this would allow you to do is instead of having trifocals, the retinal scanning and the external facing cameras would collaborate together to know the context of where, what of what I'm seeing. So am I driving? Is it day? Is it night? Am I reading a book? What are the light conditions that I'm reading the book in? Right? Am I outside playing sports? Am I inside looking at a computer as I am right now? And so if such glasses were created, I would pay a fortune for them and wear them all the time, even with all of that friction.
Right. And if you're an Apple devotee, you'd probably buy it regardless.
Yeah. Well, I do tend to buy a lot of stuff from Apple that I never use.
Yeah. Did you ever look at your Find My iPhone to see the history of all the devices? It's like you could put a few kids through college with that budget. So the idea of the challenge is represented by hardware. And I guess the reason I was bringing up the consumer electronics, the 3D example was to put a bit of a challenge on the human factor aspect of putting something on, even as light as it was. And I think the rationale you're presenting is it's just not good enough. Like you forget you're watching a 3D movie because it's not, there's no embodiment. You're not there. You're not looking around. And it's just not a sufficient value. This is kind of a, maybe a pivot into conversation in that for us to be pragmatic and see what this, it's a good moment to have where humanity is focused on something innovative, because it creates a lot of energy, and that energy creates a lot of attempts to solve the problem.
Oh yes.
And most of them will fail, as we know, as people, that entrepreneurial people, including many of our efforts will fail. But as a consequence of this, like happened in 99, there'll be something new, and that metaverse thing that's new. Now, I believe that it can't all hinge on hardware. And then the question becomes, okay, so what is this metaverse? If it's not something that you put goggles on and you go into, well, we've had video games for a while that you see on a screen, and you know, our kids kind of grew up in those worlds. I did as well. You did also. Is that the metaverse? And when we talk about the world of work, where people collaborate, create, solve, train, all these examples, is it fair to say that this can happen without the need for that jump in the human factor experience?
Well, I mean, if you believe that the metaverse is the internet, which is what most people, when they describe the metaverse, are describing, we're already in it. And the metaverse is really just a way of saying we're going to iterate our way towards something more connected and more immersive. There's a lot of confusion and misunderstanding around the metaverse. It's, you know, been an overhyped word. There's so many interpretations that almost doesn't mean anything today. I called my first book Charlie Fink's Metaverse because in my mind, a metaverse is...
What year did you publish that?
I wrote that book in 2017.
17, okay. And what does the metaverse mean to you?
Well, I was going somewhere with this. So I called it metaverse because it was the idea that everything is connected together. Hardware, software, online, offline, digital, and non-digital, right, is part of this continuing quest that we are on to transform human beings into cyborgs. So, you know, that is a continuum. Now, the metaverse has been popularized. Mark Zuckerberg has been talking about it since 2014. Matthew Ball wrote his Metaverse Manifesto in January of 2020. So it was in the air. You know, Facebook's renaming of itself and its dedication to pursuing XR came a little later, but it's obviously ignited a frenzy. That actually started before they even changed their name, when Zuckerberg announced on an earnings call over the summer that they were going to be a metaverse company. And everybody was freaking out. What the hell does that mean? Well, when they found out, they really freaked out, because what he's really talking about is investing tens of billions of dollars indefinitely on building the metaverse. In their view, honestly, and it's, their view is probably the predominant view at the moment, their view, the metaverse is the Oasis from Ready Player One, right? The Oasis was a video game that was so good, so realistic, so easy to use, that everybody dropped whatever they were doing and just set up house inside of the Oasis. You know, when Facebook says, come build it with us, they're saying, come build in our Oasis. And so I do think they will create a metaverse. But there will be many, and there are already many metaverses. First of all, you have to define a little bit what's in a metaverse, right? What does a place have to have in it? What qualities does it have to have in order to be a metaverse? And then the second thing is, will there be the metaverse, the Uber metaverse of all these other metaverses that's going to connect them together? So you can go from the world of Warcraft to the world of Second Life and take with you your digital identity, your digital assets, your currency, the contents of your smartphone with you from place to place. Now, that is a technological impossibility today. There is no meta layer. Facebook says it is also working on that. The meta layer could conceivably be, you know, the next Google, right? That would be the layer that would allow us to teleport from place to place. It would have our avatar. It would have our possessions. So it sort of would be like the HTML of spatial computing, you know, rendering both the real world as well as the digital world searchable and machine readable. You know, I think that that's what Facebook's view of the metaverse is. Then you have, like, on the opposite end, I know you want to talk about enterprise, so let's talk about NVIDIA and the Omniverse for a second. Now, I think NVIDIA regrets calling it a verse, any kind of averse, because it's created, you know, it's conflated what they're doing with consumer technology, and it is not consumer technology. It's an adaptation of Pixar's Universal Scene Description platform, which essentially allows multiple people to occupy the same virtual space with digital content and modify it together. So that is what, so you could say the Omniverse is the place where people are going to collaborate to make things for the metaverse, right? So, you know, if you wanted to build a castle and put it in Decentraland, you might build it using the Omniverse. You'd have your architect there, you'd have your developers, you know, your art director, and everybody would be sharing the same virtual space using whatever hardware they have. VR headset, AR headset, smartphone, PC. So that's a very different view and a very enterprise-centric view. That said, you know, focusing on building and creating right now is essential. Right, user-generated content that was the dirty little secret of AOL. Right, our members made most of the content that people cared about on AOL, not NBC. And then social media came along, and it was that on steroids. Right, there is no corporate content on most social media platforms. There just are hyperlinks. Most of the platform's content are created by its users. So I don't think the metaverse is going to be any different. It has to be colonized. There has to be a there to attract consumers. But, you know, we are in the phase right now where these companies, Facebook, Roblox, and others, need to create what is come to be called a creator economy. That is a way to incentivize and compensate builders for creating places in these putative metaverses.
Is there a version of what that word means that's more intimate to you, Charlie? Like, for you, the metaverse is something because of your life journey?
Well, as I said, I mean, to me, you know, look, I've been talking about the metaverse for 30 years. So sort of everybody shows up and now wants to talk about the metaverse. I'm like, okay, I'll talk about the metaverse.
It's the connectivity and this journey to this cyborg state where we're this hybrid yes. with technology.
Yes, but I also see the larger thing, right? I mean, there will be this larger connected virtual worlds, let's say. But, you know, the world is not in a great place right now for there to be one metaverse because there isn't one internet. The Chinese internet is very different than the internet we have in the West. The internet that you see in Russia is very different than the internet that we see in the West. And so just based on that, there will not be one metaverse. Now, those walls may be broken down at some point. I hope they are. And that gives hope that in the distant future, there'll be more of a utopian approach where everybody will share this oasis or whatever it turns out to be. The other thing that has not really been baked into this is what is the role of AR and the real world in the metaverse, right? Because as opposed to Ready Player One, which focused entirely on VR, in Snow Crash, people were moving between the real world and the metaverse quite fluidly. So there wasn't that much of a distinction between reality and this mirror world. So that is something that has not really been talked about enough. But AR technology, particularly for consumers, has not developed much beyond Snapchat filter. I think AR glasses are going to have a very, very hard time getting traction. I don't know what the consumer use case is. I mean, why would you buy them and put them on your head? For games? I mean, there are lots of game machines that don't require that. And that are in their 20th and 30th year of development, if you want to talk about the PlayStation. Because we were talking to PlayStation in 1995. I mean, we were talking to Sony about the PlayStation in 1995. That was, you know, 27 years ago.
Right. I guess it goes back to your thesis of the journey to cyborg state, and short of a Neuralink, having a discrete display that complements your cognition to the extent it does, and it's critical for you to navigate the world. I think that's the only use case that I can imagine. Like,
last time I said that on a podcast, somebody said, "Wait, what happened to the real Charlie?" But, you know, I mean, listen, I'm an iconoclast. I mean, I'm a deep believer and also a bit of a skeptic. I suppose that's what makes me a writer.
Yeah, I think one of the dimensions that are personal to me is when, like, if you ask me to define the metaverse very briefly, I would say it's an alternative space to the one we inhabit. And then I try to break up what that space means, and I try to use that word space in a liberal interpretation, which is not just the physical space, but it's also the space of all of the ideas that are shared in that environment.
Yes, and very much so.
Yeah. And when you talked about this one fabric, searchable, et cetera, obviously the implication is one of meaning and cognition, not of, you know, a GPS of finding a building. And I'd be interested, like, in your journey, what looking through that lens, what comes to mind for you, this idea that this is also the space of all ideas in a world where humanity is reading less and less and is more kind of leaning on communication that's live for past transfer of knowledge.
Yeah, I think that it's funny you mentioned reading, because on one hand, the smartphone has made us the most voracious readers of any generation in history. And on the other hand, what we're reading is very small bits, right? We're not reading novels on these things. We're reading CNN, right? We're reading tweets. And my students, by the way, you know, I would be really surprised if more than half of them actually did the assigned reading. In fact, in my 3 years of teaching, I have consistently lowered the reading expectations every semester, because it's just very hard to teach from a book if no one has read the book, right? Then you're just standing up there as a performing clown. So, I want to engage with them, and I want them to think critically. So reading may not be the path anymore for that kind of discourse and that kind of discussion. We have to find other ways. So, literature isn't the only thing that is being obliterated by the digital world and by this journey of our existence from atoms to bits. You know, it's part of a larger pattern of really what is education going to mean in the next 20 years. And again, that is a very big topic, because when you go to school, you're not just going to school to learn books, you're being socialized. You're learning how to work with people who are different in order to exist with them in a society, as well as work with them in a practical sense. So, you know, a lot of what goes on in school has nothing to do with reading and books. But I do think education is going to be disrupted. I think it's very inefficient. I think it is, you know, part of the reason we have such disparities in wealth, because we have huge disparities in education. And it's hard to describe, you know, the gap. We don't really live together as a society anymore. Everybody is much farther apart, and that is the fault of digital media. Yet the promise of digital media is that we're going to overcome that, and we're going to be together even when we are apart physically. So, you know, and look, I mean, wouldn't it be great if our students could learn from the greatest teachers in the world? And not just locally qualified, you know, teachers, college, math teacher. You know, so the internet and VR, I mean, VR offers an extraordinarily education experience, because you cannot be distracted in VR. There's no smartphone in VR. I mean, one of the things I hated about teaching on Zoom was I just parked all my students in front of the greatest distraction machine ever invented by man. And, you know, there's no way they're not surfing the internet while I'm talking. There's absolutely no way. It's impossible.
That also happens in a lecture hall, right? You're seeing the back of their laptops, and it's very painful.
Yes. Although the lecture hall, I can make eye contact, which is something I can't do in VR. But if somebody's learning in VR, they can't be anywhere else. They can't have their computer. They can't be looking at their phone. They can't be annoying the person next to them. And in fact, one of the most interesting things about the Ready Player One book, and I do have my students read that book, and I actually do think many of them read it, because it is a great work of futurism, even if the plot itself is rather mundane. But his description of going to high school in VR, I think, is one of the more visionary parts of that book. And so I think that you know, this technology, which is driving us apart, also offers extraordinary opportunity for us to be better, right? To make all schools better, to give all students access, which is something that we don't have today. And the other thing is the teachers are so ridiculously underpaid. It's really hard to get the best people. You know, you have to get true believers, you know, to make that kind of sacrifice that, you know, teachers are public servants. And you know, we don't value them very highly. I would also say the same of the police. I mean, you know, you're having trouble controlling the police. These are people making $40,000 and $50,000 a year. You know, so that's who you're going to attract to that profession. So, you know, to the extent that these things can be socialized, maybe the teacher can make more. You know, maybe more people would go into that profession, better people would go into that profession if they didn't think they were signing up essentially to be consigned to the lower middle class for life. Like, there aren't many college graduates who graduate saying, I want to have a $40,000 a year job for the rest of my life, right? Because you're a teacher, you don't really get raises, right? I mean, there's a pay scale based on seniority, but the difference between what the principal makes and entry-level teacher makes is probably $25,000. So, I mean, these are all things that I think technology can address. The biggest problem, right, is people. People are flawed. People are weak. When we were talking in the green room a few minutes before we started, we were talking about our today's problems going to follow us into the metaverse and going to follow us into the fourth generation of wearable ubiquitous computing. Are they going to follow us into the metaverse? And the answer is yes, because we're people. People are flawed. People are greedy. People are self-interested. This has been true since time immemorial. That's why we have laws to regulate the behavior of men, because in organizing our society, we recognize that even the most powerful and virtuous are flawed. Right? Thomas Jefferson famously said, I know how bad men are because I know myself. So, you know, I don't know that there's any way to avoid entering the metaverse. No way to avoid entering the metaverse without taking some of those evils with us. And hopefully we will develop ways to regulate that. But you can see, for example, here's a good one, Facebook Horizon. I've been in this beta for a year and it's been pretty good. And I've met a lot of amazing people. You know, it's all adults, by and large, people involved with trying to create worlds. And they opened it up, right? The beta's over. Anybody can go in there. Who is in there? 13-year-olds, right? There's no faster way to drive adults off of a platform than have them realize that everybody they're talking to is 13 years old, right? But this is who's there. This is just the natural result. I mean, you know, look at spam and bots, which, you know, have plagued us on the internet, and imagine what that can be. Imagine the brainwashing and disinformation. Imagine what that could be. If you can construct it, you know, Vladimir Putin can construct an entire world to be exactly the way he wants it. He does that with words today, but what if he could do it with technology?
So that's a good point. Like, if you think of the internet as an enabler of change, it really became this Alexandrian library for humanity in the digital form. But
yes,
it's fair to say that the metaverse represents a moment where we're moving from memory or media to kind of consciousness manipulation, because
yes,
it's you're live in the moment, and that's
it's based on experience, right. Lived experience,
right? And I think that's a distinction that probably needs to be used so people understand why this is a meaningful milestone in our embrace of technology, because and generally even in neuroscience, which always like it's always the holy grail is what is consciousness, and nobody really knows what it is, but I think as we think of a collective that we build as a species, which is embodied in our knowledge on the internet today, now we're building this collective of experience, right? And the closest thing we've had to that maybe is YouTube, right? Which is the yes. way we now learn. And so what happens, like maybe that's a useful metaphor for people to think of, like imagine a world without YouTube, right? And that's not that long ago. But when did you leave AOL, by the way?
I left AOL in 99. I was there from January of 96 until June of 99.
Yeah. So 2006, I sold one of my companies to AOL. 2008, I'm in the tower in Time Warner Building pitching the kind of the investment committee of Time Warner, which had owned AOL at the time of the merge, that the, you know, everything in the future is about digital video. And one of those leaders in the room, whose name will not be mentioned, says, I really think that this digital video thing is a fad.
Yeah, no, I was not surprised that Google bought YouTube. And the answer that I had was, YouTube has the potential to be bigger than Google. How could they possibly allow it?
But it was so perilous. When they bought YouTube, you thought they must be insane for...
I know, and it was one of those, it was one of the first billion-dollar deals. And everybody was, and at the time, Google wasn't super, you know, it was probably worth $100 billion. So that's an awful big bite to take out of a, I think they had like a dozen employees or two dozen employees. It was a tiny little startup.
Before the pivot to big tech, it was big media. And that was a very scary prospect to have Viacom sue you for IP infringement at $100,000 a pop. Like, how can they do that? That could destroy their company. So they really took a big risk in that step forward. And there's a lot of ills with YouTube, kind of like what you alluded to with how, you know, we've, but there's also so much value.
Yeah. I mean, well, Winston Churchill famously said, a lie makes its way around the world before truth can get its pants on. And, you know, so that's, I mean, that's, listen, the internet has created tremendous dangers to democracy and tremendous dangers to society. And social media in particular has weaponized that. I don't think that, I mean, we are, as humans, heedless of unintended consequences. Climate change is the biggest example, but certainly the amount of time people spend on their devices is changing us as humans. It's changing the relationship of parents and children, for example. We are infinitely available, but rarely present.
So true. And, you know, one of the reasons that I'm personally passionate about enterprise and work is because I do believe that the only way we solve problems as a species is by coming together with as a group, like we're doing now, which is a form of, you know, connecting our brains in a kind of low bandwidth connection. And the medium that we use to communicate, to collaborate, really informs our ability to solve problems. Like if we were communicating with letters that I wrote to you and a ship would bring it to you 2 months later, it would probably be a lot more prosaic and well thought through than this conversation, but it would take us a long time to solve a problem. So I think like as kind of priests in this temple of technology, I call it servicing the continuum. That's my terminology for the same thing that you mentioned.
Great way to put it.
I think that I feel it's like a holy pursuit to try to figure out how to help people solve problems, because we constantly create more of them, as evident by the horrific state of the world right now. But it's so much a two-edged sword, to your point, like that we bring ourselves wherever we go.
Yeah, that has always been the great contradiction of humanity, right? For all the good we can do, we can also perpetrate horrible evils. So, you know, how do we, it's always been a challenge through the centuries, right? How do we make sure our better angels win?
Right. And that's such a great tone to end this wonderful conversation. And I can probably talk to you for another 3 hours and hopefully we'll
do this again. We're just getting started.
It's really a pleasure to speak with someone with so much depth of experience in this world. And thank you for making the time to talk to me and for our listeners. And thank you for everything you're doing as an educator. Really important.
Thank you. Thank you.
Start your .metaverse journey today. You can claim your .metaverse Web3 domain for free right now at touchcast.com. Thank you so much for joining us. Subscribe today to stay up to date with our latest episodes.